She couldn't forget that this monster with the face of her best friend had burned villages to the ground and killed thousands, including her beloved nursemaid. Cleo brushed her hand against the side of her skirt to feel for the aquamarine orb that had been in her pocket, relieved to feel it was still there, and knowing it was a miracle that no one had discovered it while she'd been unconscious. She needed to use this opportunity to gather information she might be able to use, as much of it as she could. Cleo swallowed back her fear.
So what happens now? For now, it's enough that we're together. The four of us, Tyen said.
He tucked her hair behind her left ear and traced his finger along the blue wisp on her temple. She forced herself not to shove him away from her.
As close to true freedom as we've been as a family, Olivia added. Access to my magic already feels stronger.
It's incredible, this mortal form. I can feel everything. Taryn looked down at his hands, grinning.
I like it.
I hope you more than like it, Olivia said. This will be your vessel for all eternity.
Your vessel is perfect, Taryn replied with a nod. As is mine. Cleo noticed as a muscle in Kyan's cheek twitched.
Are you unhappy with your vessel?
Cleo asked tightly.
You should know that I love that vessel very much.
I know, Kyan said, his voice tight. And it's fine.
Really?
However, it has not been without difficulties. All souls of fire are challenging beings, hard to control. But after my little sorceress properly completes the ritual, all will be well.
Cleo tried very hard not to physically react to his words, but they had shaken her. Did he mean that Nick was fighting him for control?
I never would have guessed Nick had a soul of fire, she said instead, as calmly as possible.
Oh, no!
There were many clues of this.
Kyan placed his fingers at his temples.
Memories of his bravery, his recklessness, his tendency to fall in love in the flash of an eye or nurture an unrequited and impossible love over many years. I have his memories here. Of you, little queen. Much younger, much smaller, yet willing to take incredible risks. Leaping off high cliffs into the sea, your soul of water calling out to you even then.
That Kyan was able to access Nick's private memory shocked her.
I have always loved water, she forced herself to admit. Running as fast as many boys could, and willing to trip the ones who were faster than you so you could win the race. Including Nick. You're the reason he broke his nose when he was 12 years old.
A smile stretched his freckled cheeks.
He was mad that he was always crooked afterward, but he never blamed you. Oh, yes, he loved you very much.
She pressed her lips together. Memories of someone she'd lost coming to her as pure and painful as if they'd been yesterday. Good memories of innocent times, stolen now by a monster. It was jarring to be reminded of such fond memories through Nick's own visage, as if they might endear her to the fire kindred who'd stolen her best friend's life.
Kyan likes you, the water kindred told her. That is deeply helpful.
Yes, Cleo thought.
It just might be.
Kyan's gaze grew far away.
I can see you riding your horse fast and free.
No saddle. At least, not until your father reprimanded you.
That's no way for a young princess to behave, he told you. Try to be more like your sister.
Do you remember that?
Stop it, she hissed, unable to listen to this anymore.
These are not your memories to tell like, they're nothing but amusing stories.
I'm just trying to help, he said.
You're not! A sob rose in her throat, but she desperately swallowed it back down. Cleo took a deep breath, fighting to control her emotions before they overwhelmed her. Kyan's brows drew together,
This grieves you, and I do apologize for that. But there is no other way this ends, little queen. Allow my sibling to take control of you. It will happen soon, even if you continue to resist. It will be much easier and less painful if you comply. Your memories will also live on through her. Cleo clasped her hands together and turned away from him to study the roses carved into the marble pillar. She counted them, getting to 20 before she felt her heart begin to slow to a more manageable rate. Taryn and Olivia watched her every move, every gesture, not with kindness or understanding in their eyes, but with curiosity. Much like she would watch a newly trained puppy, amused by its antics. Cleo reached out and touched one of the marble flowers, the cold, hard surface helping to ground her.
There has to be another way. You're asking me to forfeit my life, my body, my future, so the Water Kindred can just take over? I can't. I just can't.
This is much bigger and more important than one mortal life, Taryn said. Olivia frowned at her.
You're only making this more difficult for yourself. It's illogical and rather frustrating, really. Is there nothing of Olivia left inside you? Cleo asked, desperate to know how this worked.
Memories, Olivia said, her expression now thoughtful.
Just like Cayenne has retained Nicolo's memories of Uranus, I remember the beauty of the sanctuary. I remember taking flight in hawk form and flying through the porthole to the mortal world. I remember Timotheus, someone Olivia respected far more than many of the others, who thought him far too secretive and manipulative. The others all believed in Millennia, but Olivia thought her to be a liar and a thief.
Millennia did a few things right, Cayenne said with a smile. She acquired my first vessel, one that was admittedly superior to this one in many ways.
Again, Cleo noticed the muscle in his cheek twitch.
Does Lucia know where to find us?
Cleo said, forcing the last word out.
She will, he said. How?
Cayenne cocked his head, studying her.
I can summon her. How can you summon her?
She asked again.
Be careful,
the Water Kindred said, although its tone held amusement now.
Too many questions and he will lose his patience with you.
But Cayenne's calm exterior didn't shift at all.
The magic Lucia has, the magic every common witch or immortal has, it is our magic. A part of each of us is within her, and within everyone touched by Elementia. I have not been strong enough before to use this ability, but now that the four of us are together, I feel very good and very strong. When I know it is time, I will summon her, and she will take her rightful place by my side.
Olivia muttered something under her breath. Cayenne's eyes flashed from brown to blue in an instant.
What was that? Oh, nothing, she said. Nothing at all.
Cayenne turned back to Cleo. He gave her a small smile, but any trace of warmth had disappeared from his eyes. Cleo could see that his patience was beginning to wane.
My siblings don't share the confidence I have in my little sorceress. Lucia and I have fallen upon difficult times in the recent past, but I know she will fulfill her destiny.
Interesting. And chilling. Did Taryn and Olivia not know that Cayenne had kidnapped Alyssa as an assurance of the sorceress's help?
If Lucia did anything to help Cayenne, surely it would only be to protect her daughter.
Cleo believed this almost completely. But the memory of Lucia coming to the Lemurian Palace as Cayenne's more than willing assistant still colored her confidence in Magnus's sister. She desperately wanted to ask where Lyssa was, if the baby was all right and being cared for properly, but she held her tongue,
Kayan would not harm the child. She was far too valuable alive. At least, he wouldn't harm her until Lucia resisted his demands. Cleo needed to keep talking, to draw the truth from Kayan's lips, so she could learn if there was something she could do to stop this.
"Kayan," she said as calmly as possible.
"Yes, little queen," he replied.
"At Amara's compound, you told me that I could help you because I am descended from a goddess. Was that true?"
"It certainly was." He narrowed his eyes, peering at her as if inspecting her closely.
"Your namesake.
Cleona herself is your ancestor." She gasped.
"But the goddess didn't have any children. Is that what you think?"
He smiled.
"That is only more proof that written history does not hold all secrets to the past. Cleona was destroyed in a final battle with Valoria," she countered.
"The word destroyed can mean so many things," he said.
"Perhaps only her magic was destroyed. Perhaps she was then free to live the life of a mortal at the side of the man she'd fallen in love with. Isn't that possible?"
Kayan could be lying. In fact, Cleo was quite sure of it.
"Breathe," she told herself. "Don't let him try to distract you." "Is that why the Water Kindred chose me?" she whispered. "Because I have some sort of magic already inside me. Magic that I can use to fight this," she thought.
He shook his head.
"No. You have no magic naturally within you. But don't feel badly about that. Most mortals don't, even those descended from immortals."
Disappointment seeped through her. That same muscle twitched in Kayan's cheek again.
"Taryn, Olivia, I want to speak with Cleo alone. Do you mind giving us some privacy for a few moments?"
"What do you have to say to her that you can't say in our presence?" Taryn asked.
"I'll ask again," Kayan replied tightly. "Allow us a moment of privacy. Perhaps I can convince Cleo to stop fighting against the Water Kindred and make this easier for all of us."
Olivia sighed with annoyance.
"Very well. Taryn, come, we will take a walk around the temple."
"Very well." With a nod, Taryn joined Olivia as they left the temple. Kayan stood silently in front of Cleo.
"Well," Cleo said, "speak your mind, although I assure you it will take more than words for me to give up this fight." "That's what I've always loved most about you, Cleo," he said quietly. "You never stop fighting."
Her breath caught, and she looked up into Kayan's eyes. Kayan never called her Cleo, just Little Queen.
"Nick?"
she ventured, her throat tight.
"Yes," he said, his expression strained. "It's me. It's really me."
She covered her mouth with the back of her hand as shock swept through her. Then she searched his face, fearful of letting herself feel any joy.
"How is this possible? Are you back?"
"No," he said.
"You'll regain control soon. That's why we need to be quick."
"What happened?" she asked.
"How is this possible?" "In the woods, not far from Amara's compound."
Nick touched his arm.
"Magnus was there, and he grabbed me. Or, rather, he grabbed Kayan, and I don't know why. But it was like a slap to the face, waking me up. Asher was there, too. I thought he might have done some kind of magic. Some spell that caused me to regain a tiny bit of presence. I don't know. It might have been my imagination that he was even there." "Asher is still with us," Cleo said. "He won't leave, not for any reason. He's determined to help save you, Nick."
Hope filled his brown eyes.
"I've been such an annoyance to him from the moment we first met."
"Funny."
A small smile pulled at her lips.
"I think he believes the opposite.
Ever since then, I have moments of control like this," when the fire god isn't conscious. Kyan blames the interrupted ritual, but I know it's more than that. It doesn't happen to Olivia that I'm aware of. Cleo reached toward him, touching his freckled cheek. He clasped his hand on top of hers and squeezed it. Hot tears spilled down her cheeks.
"Can we stop them?"
she asked, her throat raw. Nick took a breath before he replied. "Kyan wants the orbs, all four of them, and then he needs Princess Lucia to do the ritual again. He truly believes that she will do it without argument, and it will go perfectly, giving the four of them ultimate power. They don't have it yet. Their magic has its limits."
"When does he want the ritual to happen?" she asked.
"I don't know exactly. Soon. Very soon. He met with Lucia at the palace, presented his plan to her, left it in her hands to decide. But he has no doubt that she will join them."
His voice dropped to a whisper.
"Cleo, I think Lucia is still evil."
Cleo shook her head.
"No, I don't believe that. Kyan has her baby. He stole Lyssa from her cradle. Don't you remember that? Where is she right now?"
"Lyssa, I don't know."
Nick's eyes full of shock at this news, he shook his head.
"I'm not always conscious. I see very little, but what little I do see in here, I remember. Like, I very clearly remember when Kyan marked Curtis, made him into his slave. I remember the way he screamed, 'I don't care about Curtis.'"
His expression grew pained.
"I'm trying to think, but I don't remember ever seeing Lyssa here. I remember Kyan went to visit Lucia at the palace, but I don't remember him taking the baby. She could be anywhere."
Cleo tried to think it through, trying to piece together this puzzle.
"What happens if Kyan doesn't possess the crystals?"
"Then he will burn the world," the Water Kindred told her. "And everyone in it."
A shiver went down Cleo's spine.
"Nothing good," Nick said.
Then he swore under his breath.
"I can't hold on to this control for much longer. But you have to. You can't let what happened to Taran happen to you. You can't let the Water Kindred take you over."
Cleo pulled off one of her silk gloves and touched the blue lines on her hand.
"I don't know how much longer I can resist. Every time I feel like I'm drowning, I'm certain I will die."
"Stay strong," Nick urged. "Because you need to gather the orbs together and destroy all four of them."
She gasped.
"What? Ridiculous. He doesn't know what he's saying," the Water Kindred sneered.
Yet there was something now in its voice, something pained.
"Ignore him. Listen only to Kyan. He will help you."
"Kyan helps no one but himself,"
Cleo muttered. And then louder.
"Nick, what do you mean, destroy them? The orbs are the Kindred's prisons."
He shook his head.
"Not prisons, not exactly. The orbs are anchors, Princess. Anchors keeping them on this level of existence. If you destroy all four, then there will be no remaining ties to this world for them."
"You know this. You know this for certain."
Nick nodded.
"Yes."
"Foolish boy," the Water Kindred snarled. "He speaks his last words, full of falsehood and desperation. So mortal, so pathetic."
The more fiercely the Water Kindred protested, the more Cleo was certain that Nick was right.
I can't hold on,"
Nick managed. Then he cried out in pain.
"You need to go. Go now and do as I say. Don't let them catch you."
A wall of fire blazed up around him, forming a circle of flames and blocking him from Cleo's view. She wanted to help Nick, wanted him to escape with her, but knew that couldn't happen. Not now. Cleo turned and ran out of the temple as far and as fast as she could. Chapter 24. Nick, Uranus. All he could see were flames,
as tall as he was, surrounding him on every side. Then Nick felt as if he'd been punched in the gut, rendering him immobile as Kyan took control again. That had been the longest he'd taken control of both his body and of Kyan's fire magic. He'd called for flames to shield Cleo's escape, and flames had appeared. It had hurt like hell, but he took pride in his accomplishments tonight. He didn't know how he'd been able to push through. Perhaps it had been the sight of Cleo, with frightening blue lines curling around the left side of her face, glaring at Kyan with so much courage and strength that it broke Nick's heart. He knew he had to do something to help her. Kyan and Taryn and Olivia would not have allowed her to leave. They would have put her in chains had she tried to escape. With Cleo here, even without the Water Kindred being in control of her body, Nick had felt Kyan's power double in strength. Kyan waved his hand, and the fire disappeared. It left a black, scorched circle on the pristine marble. Nick sensed that Kyan found it distasteful and imperfect, a physical marking of his failure to control the mortal inside him. He scanned the temple for Cleo, but she was gone.
"You think you're clever," Kyan said under his breath. "So very clever, don't you?"
Actually, yes, Nick did think he was clever. And if he'd had any significant control over his body now, he would have made the rudest of gestures toward the Fire Kindred.
"Not much longer now, and you will be nothing but a memory," Kyan said darkly. "One I will toss away and forget as if you never existed in the first place."
That was rude, Nick thought, and it only made him want to fight harder to survive. Kyan moved toward the exit, searching for Curtis and finding him lurking outside in the shadows.
"Come here," he growled.
Nick had swiftly gone from empathizing with Curtis's pain when he had received his branding to hating his pathetic guts again. Curtis was a coward, willing to do anything if it meant he would not personally suffer. Surely, he'd offer up his own grandmother's soul if it meant avoiding even a moment of discomfort. It helped a little that Kyan, too, deeply disliked the former King's Liege.
"Did you see her escape?" Kyan demanded.
"Who?" Curtis asked. Fury rose up inside Kyan, and his fists and forearms lit with flames. Curtis's eyes filled with fear at the sight.
"The princess!" Kyan hissed.
Curtis began to tremble.
"I'm so sorry, master. I didn't see her."
"Go after her. Find her and bring her back here immediately. She couldn't have gotten far."
Curtis scanned the forest.
"What direction did she take? Just find her!"
Kyan boomed.
"Fail, and you will burn."
Curtis ran down the temple stairs and dashed into the forest.
"If I go after the little queen," Kyan muttered, "I might mistakenly scorch her beyond repair. Wouldn't want that, would we, Nicolo?"
How Nick desperately despised this monster.
"You see? You've only made it worse for her," Kyan continued. "There is no escape for the little queen. The Water Kindred will rise whether she allows it or not. We cannot be stopped. We are eternal. We are life itself, and we will do anything to survive."
"Blow it out your ass, you burned-up piece of cow dung," Nick thought.
"This evening has proven one thing to me, Nicolo."
Kyan leaned against a marble pillar, running a hand absently through his stolen red hair. "The time has come to fully embrace the power that is already ours. The pieces are in place. The means to perform the ritual perfectly is at my fingertips. The little queen will rejoin me, Olivia, and Taryn, and all will be well for all eternity." He gazed up at the temple with distaste.
"But not here."
Kyan went silent, thoughtful.
"I believe I know the perfect place."
Chapter 25 Magnus, Uranus. The temple lay before Magnus, utterly and completely restored to its former grandeur. Apart from the massive statue of the goddess Cleona that still lay shattered at the top of the 30 chiseled stairs leading to the entrance, the temple was pristine. Juts of fire rose up from the ground and lined the marble walls, giving light to an area that would have been otherwise in darkness. At the forest line, with the temple in clear sight before them, Magnus and Asher tethered the horses they'd taken from the palace stables. They'd ridden so fast, there'd been no chance for conversation. Magnus was about to say something to Asher, some comment about it being earth magic that had to be the reason for the temple's restored appearance, when Asher hushed him.
"Look,"
Asher said, nodding toward the temple grounds. Magnus peered around the trunk of a tree to see Curtis emerge from the palace. He lingered at the top of the marble steps leading into the temple sanctuary for several moments, glancing behind him with annoyance before he stomped down the steps to the ground, where a long, winding stone pathway led through a series of overgrown flower gardens with several grand statues of the goddess.
"I'm going to kill him," Magnus growled.
"Best not to show ourselves quite yet," Asher replied. "Just observe."
"Cleo's in there."
"Likely, yes. And so are three elemental gods who could kill us with a single thought." Magnus squeezed his eyes shut, summoning patience he did not possess. But he knew Asher was right. They had to watch, observe, and then, when they got their chance, they would make their move. Curtis lit a cigarillo, then disappeared around the left side of the temple. A moment later, two other figures emerged, Olivia and Taryn. They walked side by side, leisurely, as if there was no rush, no worry, no urgency. Magnus knew they weren't who they appeared to be. Not Olivia, Jonas's friend, the one Magnus had believed to be a witch until his shocking discovery that she was much more than that. And Taryn, a young man who had initially wanted Magnus dead for the murder of his twin brother, at least until they'd come to an understanding about past mistakes and regrets. Olivia and Taryn were gone, stolen, and Magnus swore he would do whatever he could to help restore them to their former selves, vanquishing the demons who'd stolen their bodies. Asher gripped his arm, startling him from his thoughts.
"It's Cleo."
Magnus's gaze shot back to the temple, where he was shocked to see Cleo's golden hair glowing from firelight along her path as she ran down the stairs of the temple and into the forest 100 paces away from him. He immediately started to move, to go after her. Asher's grip on him tightened.
"Don't try to stop me," Magnus growled.
Asher's expression was grim.
"Are you sure it's the princess anymore? It may be the Water Kindred."
Magnus's blood turned to ice at the thought.
"I'm going after her."
"Magnus, go!" he snapped.
"Summon Valya again. If she can help us in any way, I will beg for her forgiveness for how rude I was to her earlier. Meet me at the Silver Toad tomorrow morning, if I'm not there. Well, you'll know that the princess is gone, and likely so am I."
He didn't wait for any confirmation from the Cretian prince. He turned and ran in the direction Cleo had taken, into the woods on the east side of the temple. He ran as fast as he could in the near darkness, trying not to stumble and fall over the roots of trees along the forest floor. For a moment, Magnus feared he had lost her, but then he saw movement ahead.
"If she is the Water Kindred, she may be trying to lure me to my death," he thought.
That was not a hopeful thought, or remotely helpful. His mind would do well to stay silent for now. The forest opened to a small clearing at the edge of a 20-foot-wide river. Magnus staggered to a halt at the tree line, and watched Cleo also come to a stop, scanning right and left, as if looking for a bridge in the meager moonlight. Magnus stepped out from the shadows.
"I'm not sure it's the best time for a swim," he said.
Cleo's shoulders tensed. Magnus was ready for anything as she slowly turned around to face him. In the moonlight, her eyes shone, but their color was lost in darkness. Grays and blacks with no trace of aquamarine. The frightening vine-like lines on her throat, moving up over her jaw to her left temple, were almost black against her pale skin.
"You found me,"
she said in a half-whisper.
"Of course I did.
His throat thickened, making it hard to swallow.
Is it you?
She stared at him.
Who else would I be?
Magnus let out a sharp, nervous laugh at that.
Tharin lost his battle against the Air Kindred. And then they took you. What am I to think?
A small smile touched her lips.
It's still me.
The knot in his stomach loosened a bit.
Good. You're not getting away from me so easily. I swear, Cleo, I will fight for you until my very last...
And then something hit him hard from behind. Something sharp and painful. Cleo's eyes went wide.
No! She cried out. Magnus, no!
He forced himself to look down. The bloody tip of a sword now protruded from his chest. He blinked, then fell to his knees as the weapon was yanked from his body. Vaguely he registered that the ground was cold and wet. It had started to rain hard, yet only a few moments ago there had been no clouds in the sky.
I don't know how you did it before.
Curtis's reedy voice met Magnus's ears as the King's Liege moved out from behind him.
I thought surely your little sister's magic helped you out of your grave. But that doesn't explain the alleyway. But no matter.
His teeth glittered in the moonlight as he grinned.
You're dead, Magnus. Finally.
Magnus's foggy vision found Cleo still standing at the water's edge. Her skin as pale as the moon itself. Her hair was slicked from the torrents of rain beating down. The ground all around her was now coated with an icy layer.
I will kill you, Cleo snarled.
I know you have no conscious control over this,
Curtis gestured toward the ice.
So stop being a nuisance and let me return you to your new family.
Magnus tried to speak, but he couldn't form words.
What is that?
Curtis held a hand to his ear.
I'm always intrigued by the last words of my enemies. Louder, if you please.
You thought, Magnus managed. It would be that easy.
Curtis rolled his eyes.
Just die already, would you?
It took a moment before Magnus felt the wound begin to knit itself together. The look of utter shock on the young lord's face as Magnus rose to his feet was almost worth the agony Magnus had just experienced.
Magnus!
Cleo gasped, tears spilling to her cheeks.
I thought yet again that I'd lost you. Just like I lost...
Her voice broke. She didn't have to finish her thought.
Just like she'd lost Theon. I know, he said grimly.
Curtis hadn't tried to escape. He stood there, stunned by the sight before him.
This is dark magic.
Oh, yes.
Magnus moved toward him, his fists clenched at his sides.
This is the darkest, blackest, foulest magic there is. If there is an opposite to Elementia, I am in full possession of it.
He grabbed Curtis by his throat and slammed him hard against the nearest tree trunk.
Mercy!
Curtis sputtered.
Have mercy! I'm branded by Cain's fire! I have no choice but to do what he says!
Did you even know Cain when you had me buried 6 feet beneath the ground?
Curtis grimaced.
I beg for your forgiveness for every transgression I've ever committed against you. Please, have mercy on me!
You are a pathetic, sniveling coward,
Magnus spat. His absolute hatred for this piece of worthless shit who had threatened Cleo and tried to murder Magnus on 3 separate occasions spilled over. He had never wanted to kill anyone as much as this.
Listen to me,
Curtis sputtered.
I think you will find me incredibly helpful if you let me go.
Then he gasped, a dry, wrenching sound from deep in his throat.
What are you doing to me?
As Magnus tightened his grip on his neck, Curtis's face began to turn gray and sallow in the moonlight. Thick black veins raced up his throat and covered his entire face in a gruesome web. His dark hair turned stark white from root to tip. The life faded from his eyes. When Magnus finally let go of him, the desiccated corpse of Curtis Cirillo collapsed to the ground, his brittle bones snapping like dry twigs. Magnus stared down at him, astounded by what he'd just done.
Magnus!
Cleo was beside him now, her voice not more than a whisper.
How is this possible?
The bloodstone, he replied softly, sliding his right hand over the ring on his left middle finger. She looked up at him, her eyes wide.
Did you know it could do that?
I had no idea. He waited to feel horror for what he'd done, but it didn't come.
All I know is I wanted him dead. And now he's dead and I feel... relieved.
Cleo reached out a trembling hand toward him.
Be careful, he managed. I don't want to hurt you.
She let out a small, nervous laugh.
I assume that you don't want me dead as you did Curtis.
Of course not.
Good, she managed. Because I desperately need you to kiss me right now.
And so he did kiss her, breathing her in and gathering her so tightly in his arms that her feet lifted off the ground.
I love you, he whispered against her lips.
So damn much it hurts.
Cleo pressed her hands to either side of his face, looking into his eyes.
I love you too.
She was his goddess, his love, his life, and he would do anything to save her. On his finger was a piece of dark magic that had now saved his life three times. The one who created it 1,000 years ago had surely been a god of death. This had been his ring then, but now it was Magnus's, and he would not hesitate to use its horrible, terrifying, incredible death magic on anyone who might get in his way. Chapter 26 Amara Cretia. A week had passed since she'd returned to the Jewel of the Empire, and the world had not yet ended. Amara took that as an excellent sign to forget Mitica and enjoy every single moment of her day of ascension, the day she would officially, and in all ways, become the absolute ruler of the Cretian Empire. She hoped very much that the ceremony would help to burn away any remaining traces of pain, uncertainty, or weakness unbefitting an empress. But even a strong, capable, and powerful ruler needed a pretty gown for a formal ceremony.
Ouch!
She said when she felt the prick of a needle wielded by clumsy hands.
Be careful.
My deepest apologies,
the dressmaker said, jumping back, his gaze filled with horror. Amara stared at him through the reflection in the tall mirror in her chambers. What an incredible overreaction. It wasn't as if she was going to kill him for being clumsy. She almost laughed out loud.
It's fine. Just be careful.
Yes, my empress.
Lorenzo Tavera was from Aranus, where he ran a famous dress shop in the city of Hawk's Brow. Amara's grandmother had learned that he'd been a favored dressmaker of nobles and royals alike. He'd even made Princess Cleo's wedding gown, which by all accounts had been breathtakingly beautiful before being soiled by the blood of rebels. The golden gown Lorenzo had created for Amara fit tightly to her curves. The skirt flouncing outward from the knee in what looked like golden feathers. The bodice had intricate embroidery made of tiny crystal beads and larger emeralds and amethysts. The color of the gown made Amara think of the golden princess herself, and she wondered how Cleo fared in her current situation. Was she suffering, or had she already been lost to the Water Kindred?
My fault, she thought.
No, she couldn't dwell on such things. She couldn't dwell on how she'd helped a demon gain power, and how she'd left everyone, including her brother, far behind her. She couldn't think about how Kyan was a god with an extreme distaste for the imperfect mortals that swarmed over this world, mortals he believed were led only by greed and lust and vanity, weaknesses he wanted to erase.
Everyone everywhere would perish.
Dosha, is everything all right?
Neela asked as she entered the room.
Yes, of course. Everything is fine.
Amara forced the words out, feeling as very unfine as she possibly could, despite the glory of the day and the beauty of this gown.
"Your beautiful face,"
her grandmother met her gaze in the mirror's reflection.
"You looked so pained and worried for a moment there."
She shook her head.
"Not at all." "Good."
Neela came close enough to touch the fine stitching of the gown.
"Lorenzo, you have created a true masterpiece."
"Much gratitude, my queen," the dressmaker said. "It is only by your grace that I have been given the incredible honor to dress the empress."
"It's everything I dreamed it would be,"
Neela said, sighing with appreciation.
"What about the wings?"
"Yes, yes, of course. They are the most magnificent part of my creation."
Lorenzo reached into a silk bag and pulled out a large but delicate golden piece. It fit over Amara's shoulders and gave the illusion of golden wings. Amara gritted her teeth, finding the addition to be a rather heavy and unnecessary burden. But she chose not to complain, since they added an ethereal, otherworldly touch.
"Perfect,"
Neela breathed, clapping her hands.
"Today you will have everything I have ever wanted for you. I am honored to have been able to make all this possible."
In the week since Amara had visited Micah Kazuro in his forgetting room, where he would stay until he was brought out for his execution during the ceremony, she tried not to think about their conversation. A part of it had stayed in her mind, though, like a piece of stubborn food between her back teeth, nearly impossible to dislodge.
"Your grandmother only believes in her own desire for power," he told her.
"I'm so glad you approve," Amara said softly. "Did you come here just to get a glimpse of the gown, Madhosha?"
Lorenzo pricked her again with his needle, and she slapped his hand away.
"Enough," she scolded him. "Enough fixing of things that are already perfect."
Lorenzo backed away from her immediately, bowing deeply.
"Yes, of course."
Again there was that fear in his eyes. It was the same kind of fear she remembered seeing in the eyes of those who looked upon her father. Such power over others should please her. Instead, it gave her a cold, empty feeling in the pit of her stomach.
"I will be a good leader," she told Micah. "My people will love me."
"And if they don't?" he countered. "If they rise up and try to change what has been thrust upon them through no choice of their own, will you have them put to death?"
"Dosha," her grandmother said sharply, as if she tried to get her attention more than once while Amara was lost in her thoughts.
"Yes."
She looked around, pulling herself from her thoughts. Lorenzo was no longer in the room. She hadn't even noticed him leave.
"You asked me if I was here only to see the gown," Neela said. "I am not. I am happy to say that your gift has finally arrived from across the sea."
Amara shook her head.
"You really didn't need to get me a gift, Madhosha. You've already done so much for me."
Neela smiled.
"But this gift is special. Come with me now to receive it."
Amara changed back into her casual gown and shawl. The rest of the day would be one of relaxation, meditation, and rest. Then she would be coiffed from head to toe, paint applied precisely to her eyes and lips, her black hair plaited and threaded with jewels, and the finished gown would be the last touch before the ascension ceremony itself. Leaning on her cane, Amara followed Neela through the hallways of the Emerald Spear. They passed several servants, all with eyes lowered to the ground. To look the Creation royal family directly in the eyes was not permitted, since Amara's father had felt it was confrontational. Priests and augurs also filled the halls, clad in long purple robes. They had journeyed to the Emerald Spear from across the Empire to be a part of the Ascension. The long corridors were lined with intricately embroidered rugs that had taken a commissioned artisan half a lifetime to complete. Amara realized she never paid much attention to the beauty of her surroundings, to the exquisite vases and sculptures and paintings that peppered the palace halls, many obtained from the kingdoms her father had conquered.
"Stolen,"
not obtained, she reminded herself. These were the possessions of former kings and queens, slain by the Emperor as he moved across this world like a plague. What am I thinking? She shook her head to clear it of such dark thoughts. Her father was gone. Her older brothers gone. She'd heard not a word about Asher. Amara knew she would be different from those who had ruled before her. They climbed the private spiraling staircase to the sixth floor and walked down another long hallway. At the end of the hallway was a familiar face, one that made Amara's worries disappear and her smile return.
Kostas!
As she drew closer to her trusted guard, he bowed before her.
How lovely to have you here to help me celebrate this important day.
Empress, Kostas said, I am here by request of Queen Neela.
Queen Neela.
She noticed that many addressed her grandmother in this way now. But of course they would. She was the closest relative and the most trusted advisor of the Empress. Her grandmother deserved such a title. Amara turned toward Neela, smiling.
Did you secretly summon Kostas here as my gift? If so, much gratitude.
Neela shook her head.
No. However, Kostas did acquire your gift, and he brought it here at great risk to himself.
She gestured toward the door next to the tall guard.
Your true gift is within this room.
How intriguing. What rare treasure had Kostas brought for her at her grandmother's request on the day of her ascension? Amara went to the door, pressing her hand flat against its cool, smooth surface. Despite any misgivings or doubt, she swore she would enjoy every moment of today, to taste it, to savor it. Whatever this mysterious gift was, she had earned it. Amara opened the door and entered the small room. A woman, dressed all in white, turned to face her, then dropped her gaze to the floor. She bowed deeply and moved away from the small piece of furniture she stood before. It looked very much like a cradle. Her breath shallow, Amara moved forward, slowly, and looked inside. A baby with sky-blue eyes and a dark tuft of hair stared up at her. Amara gasped, clamping a hand over her mouth. Neela came to her side.
Do you like my gift?
Matosha, what have you done? Amara asked, breathless.
Do you know whose child this is?
Neela asked. Amara could barely think, let alone speak.
It's Lucia de Mora's daughter.
You made no mention of her existence. I had to learn it from Kostas. This child is the daughter of a prophesied sorceress and an immortal. A child of such extraordinary parents will contain incredible magic. Magic we can use for so many things.
Amara's grip on her cane tightened.
Matosha!
Neela reached down into the cradle and stroked the baby's tiny velvet-smooth cheek.
What shall we name her?
She already has a name. It's Lissa.
Amara turned to Kostas.
You did this. You took her from her cradle. From the arms of a mother who will level the world to find her.
Kostas' expression remained steady.
She won't. She will! The moment Lucia learns that you took her...
I thought of that, he interrupted her.
Of course I did. Queen Neela gave explicit instructions to make it appear as if the Fire Kindred had stolen her. The only one who witnessed me enter the palace is dead, burned as proof.
More reason for the sorceress to focus her attention on this Fire Kindred you cannot find a way to control, Neela said. We will raise this child as your daughter, just as King Gaius raised Lucia herself. My apothecary tells me he can use her blood to create powerful elixirs to strengthen your reign. Elixirs to keep you young and beautiful for many, many years.
Elixirs,
Amara repeated, again looking down upon the face of this stolen child.
To keep me young and beautiful, Yes.
Neela then kissed Amara on both of her cheeks.
I am so happy to have been able to give you this gift, one you will appreciate more with every passing year.
Every passing year that Queen Neela advised her on how to rule her people, how to control them, and how to punish those who would oppose them.
I don't want the gift of a stolen child, Amara thought with a sudden, clawing desperation in her chest. I don't want any of this. What have I done?
Still, uncertain how her grandmother would react if she blurted out the truth of how she felt, Amara instead forced a smile to her lips.
My gratitude to you, Matosha, for always looking out for me, for making today possible.
Neela squeezed her hands.
They will all bow before you. Every man who has ever made a Kreshian woman suffer. And you will be the greatest and most fearsome ruler this world has ever seen.
Amara continued to smile her false smile as she left the nursery and headed back to her chambers. She walked as quickly as she could, fighting against the tears pricking the backs of her eyes. It had been her grandmother's idea to poison her family. It had been her grandmother's idea for her to kill Asher if he proved to be a problem. It had been her grandmother's idea to kidnap the child of a sorceress. Amara had trusted her grandmother all her life, had been willing to do whatever she said. Knowing that Neela only wanted to help her gain power, power that Neela could wield for herself. Her thoughts jumbled and unclear, her vision blurry. Amara didn't see the person hiding around the corner that led to her wing of the massive royal residence. At least, not until they grabbed her. Her cane fell away from her grip before she could use it to fight back against the large hand that grasped her throat and pinned her up against the wall. The tip of a sharp blade pressed to her cheek.
Well, that was easier than I would have predicted,
Felix Gabrus growled.
Not enough security in the big green pointy palace to keep escaped criminals like me at bay. What a crying shame.
The sight of him was such a shock that Amara didn't react, didn't struggle, as he dragged her into her vacant chambers. He shoved her, and she stumbled backward and fell to the floor. The door clicked shut, the lock sliding into place. Amara glanced at the door. Felix had not sneaked into the Emerald Spear alone.
Nerissa,
Amara whispered. Her former attendant's eyes narrowed coldly on her.
With Mitika so far behind you, I would have thought you'd have forgotten my name by now.
Of course not.
Amara tried to swallow, tried to breathe, tried not to seem afraid.
Are you going to stop Felix from killing me?
No. Actually, I'm here to help him.
Amara stared at both of them for several long moments. And then she started to laugh, drawing glares from both Nerissa and Felix. The day had been so surreal, from the golden wings, to the fear in the dressmaker's eyes, to the gift of a stolen baby with magical blood.
Stop laughing, Felix shouted.
What is this?
Nerissa asked.
Are you mad?
By now?
She managed.
Very likely. But you, Nerissa, an accomplice to the murder of an unarmed woman. I never would have taken you as that cold-hearted.
Amara was struck by the certainty that the punishment she deserved had arrived far sooner than she'd expected.
I wish I could say the same in return,
Nerissa said softly. Amara sobered, narrowing her gaze on her former attendant. One who had looked at her not so long ago with kindness and patience. One who had shared stories from her painful past.
You told me that you and your mother survived so much under my father's reign. You know what it's like to be oppressed by men, to need to use them to get what you want. I would think you'd understand, if only a little, why I've done what I've done. What I told you about my mother being a courtesan was a lie.
Nerissa raised a thin eyebrow.
She did what was necessary to survive, yes. But on most days, my mother was an assassin.
Felix gasped.
You never told me that. We have so much in common, Nerissa glanced at him.
Your mother wasn't an assassin.
No, but I am!
Oh, Nerissa, you get more interesting to me every day. We could be partners after this. Vigilantes who slay horrible, evil creatures across the world. Although, if we could avoid sea travel, that would be wonderful. I'm still ill from our trip here.
Nerissa scrunched her nose.
That, all of it, is unlikely, Felix.
He frowned and brushed his fingers over his eye patch.
Is it the missing eye? Can't do much about that, I'm afraid. Oh, wait, that's the Empress's fault, too. Another reason she needs to die.
He looked down at his knife and his single eye narrowed.
I'm going to enjoy this so much.
Nerissa sighed wearily.
Are you trying to talk yourself into yet another dungeon?
Definitely not. Felix spun his dagger around on his hand with the skill of someone who played with sharp weapons daily.
Before I finally and happily do this, Empress, I am obligated to let you know that this is on Prince Magnus's orders. He's not happy that you had his father killed.
Amara finally pushed herself up to her feet, balancing her weight on her good leg. Despite her problems, her will to survive remained as strong as ever.
It wasn't me. My grandmother enlisted that assassin. I only learned of it when I arrived here last week.
Felix shrugged.
You say all of that like it matters. It doesn't. The result is going to be the same. You being dead, that is.
Amara shot a look at Nerissa.
And you're going to just stand there and watch him kill me? Yes. I am.
Nerissa crossed her arms and tapped her foot as if Amara's death couldn't come soon enough.
Before that night, with Kyan when I betrayed all of you. I thought you believed in me,
Amara said, horrified by how weak she sounded. But it was still the truth. She had no more lies left within her.
I did. Against my better judgment, I really did.
Nerissa exhaled and shook her head.
But you've shown no remorse, no regret. Every decision you've made has been for your own gain, and countless people have suffered because of it.
Felix spun his dagger again.
And you say I talk a lot. Can we end this and get out of here?
End this. End her. Felix had countless reasons to want Amara dead. She actually didn't blame him at all. She'd hurt him very badly. No. She'd tried to destroy him, but he survived.
I admire that,
Amara said.
What?
Felix growled.
You. I see now that you would have made a much better ally than an enemy.
He frowned at her.
I was hoping for more satisfying begging for your life at this point. This is extremely disappointing. It's over,
Amara said.
Exactly my point.
Felix gave her a cold smile and stepped forward. She raised a hand and lifted her chin.
But you can't kill me. Not right now. Later, perhaps. But not now. There's far too much for you to do first. And you're going to need a great deal of my help to do it.
Nah, I think I'm just going to kill you, Felix insisted and raised his dagger. Nerissa grabbed his wrist in midair, her eyes trained on Amara.
What are you talking about?
Amara racked her brain, trying to figure out exactly where to begin.
All right, she said. Listen to me very carefully.
Chapter 27 Jonas, Palsea. They left the inn at dawn. Mia, the serving girl with amnesia, the one Lucia insisted was an immortal, was already awake, serving breakfast, and she provided them with some stale bread and honey for their journey. On their way into the Forbidden Mountains, Lucia barely spoke. She moved swiftly along the rough-hewn path, clearly determined to make headway. Jonas peered up at the jagged black peaks rising all around them, and drew his cloak closer around his shoulders. There was a chill here, the temperature far colder than in the small village they'd departed earlier. It was a chill he felt more profoundly than